I found myself, as I sat down to sit in this period before the talk, waiting. I was waiting for the bell to ring to start the sitting period. And I waited. I waited. No bells rang. And I realized that, of course, because I was waiting for something to happen, I was completely focused on that waiting and that expectation rather than just sitting here. And then I forgot about the bell. And when the bell rang, finally, it was to end the period. So I'm a little confused about what happened, but I don't care because it was an interesting experience to see myself waiting, which is what we do all the time. We have an idea of what should happen in our life, in a moment, in our work, in our relationships, in a sitting period. And then we spend our entire, all of our attention, all of our energy is focused on that result, what we are expecting to happen. And either it doesn't happen, and then many things come up around that, or it does happen, but it's not like we wanted it to be. The bell did ring, but it wasn't to start the period, it was to end it. So, and this is something I know happens to me regularly in my life, and I'm sure that you can all recognize aspects of this in your lives. The practice, what we call the practice, involves seeing that and experiencing then life, including that. So I included that expectation in my sitting practice as I sat here for half an hour and became aware of it. And then it was just like something like the rooster crowing, or the cat who came in this morning, or a thought that passes, or the car that drives by. It's just something else that's here now. Which allows the space for us to then experience things fully. Because my attention is not, I'm not sitting here waiting for that rooster because I want the rooster to crow, or I don't want it to, or simply because that's what I'm used to hearing, and so then if I don't hear it, or I do hear it, whatever, however I'm expecting it, this raises some waves. Rather than just allowing things to be and having the expectation of no expectation, maybe, which is already an expectation. So then we become aware of that expectation. Earlier, something else unexpected happened. I bumped into I banged my face on the shutter of in front of the window that I knew was at that level. I didn't dunk my head down to go under, right? So I banged right into it. And this was also an interesting incident. This is also very interesting. My attention at that moment was on something entirely different. I was thinking about something else that I had to do. And I was even saying it to the person who was with me. I have to do this or something. And then bang. That's when we say life happens, or sometimes we say shit happens. That's it, right? And that kind of thing happens all the time. Every single moment is that. But usually it doesn't come in the form of our face hitting something physically. So we don't experience it in that same way. It brought my attention back to, oh, yes, the physical circumstances of this place where I am were this way, and I wasn't paying attention to it, and so bang, I banged into it. If I had been aware of my circumstances, I wouldn't have bumped into it, probably. Of course, my awareness sometimes we think of our awareness as being unlimited. You say, okay, panoramic awareness, something we talk about. Being aware of everything. This is a problematic belief because there are things we cannot be aware of. I am not aware of what is going on in the house over there right now. I'm aware of that, though, but I'm not aware of that. So maybe the awareness, the panoramic awareness, entails being aware of the limits of our awareness. And when, so both of these incidents of waiting for the bell to ring and then it not ringing and not expecting the shutter to be there that I would bang my face into it, are both simple examples of how life in its totality is practice. So, usually we think of a sitting meditation as being something outside of practice, outside of life. And that we go into a retreat, we go out of life because this is what it's really about. In fact, that's not what it's really about. This is an aspect of life. The retreat is an aspect of life. And maybe the retreat, I've heard someone somewhere, I forget who it was, who said that the retreat is not actually complete until we return to our daily life. And then it's complete, the retreat. That our daily life is actually part of the retreat. That one would not exist without the other. There would be no retreat if there were not daily life. Because we wouldn't call it a retreat otherwise. It only exists in contrast to daily life. And usually we approach retreat, this retreat idea or concept, in a materialistic way. So we think of it as I will accomplish something here. I may accomplish, I may think I will become peaceful, I will be relaxed, I may acquire some knowledge, I will acquire some distance from my problems in my life, I will become more powerful, more clear. I will obtain this beautiful feeling of bliss. people will like me more, people will think I'm really interesting if I do the retreat and I acquire these wonderful things. This is a very materialistic approach to the retreat. And everyone is free to believe those things about the retreat. However, probably you will have some disappointments that accompany those expectations. It's like me waiting for the bell to ring, and it didn't ring. So there was some disappointment there. Why did I want the bell to ring? Of course, I can say because that's how I'm used to it happening. Or I could say, well, I wanted to give some structure so that there's a clear beginning and a clear end. That's true, that's valid. But as soon as I start clinging to those expectations and those beliefs about how it should happen, then I become caught. And I'm no longer it's no longer about just being present. It's about arranging the present to fit some idea I have of how it should be. And the same thing with our coming to a retreat with these ideas of materialist ideas of what should happen and what we want to happen. We want to acquire, we want to accumulate, we want to consume. Or another very common thing that happens to us is we want to keep things out. Okay, well, I'm okay with certain aspects of the retreat, but other aspects, no. I don't want to do this, I don't want to do that, I don't want to do the other thing, I don't agree with that, I don't like that. Fine. We all have parts of it we like and parts of it we don't like. This is also very materialist. I'm rejecting what feels threatening to what I like. Or maybe it's not even what I like. So it's very subtle and it takes a very twisted path sometimes. I'm rejecting things that in fact I do like. Or I'm rejecting things that I think are threatening to me. Or threatening to my idea I have about myself is more appropriate. Instead of, you know, I reject the idea that the bell doesn't ring when I expect it to ring. In fact, then, as I observed that was happening, I didn't reject it anymore. I just welcomed it. I said, okay, the bell isn't ringing, I have this expectation, and what do I explain to you? Right. Or when I banged into the shutter, I didn't curse the shutter and say, oh, that stupid thing, why was it there? This bad place, very inconvenient, someone should have told me about it, whatever, you know, all kinds of things like that. In fact, I recognized right away that I'm the one who put it like that. And I'm the one who walked into it. And when I say I, this is not a sort of self-involved, it's just acknowledging the fact of what the situation was. And it didn't mean I was bad or stupid. It didn't mean the house was bad or stupid or not well done. It's just what happened. And I could see why. I was aware of it. And I moved on then. I'm only telling you all of this as a kind of, it's the first day. A lot of you have never been in one of our retreats before. To give you just an indication for the new people, but also for people who have been here before, for all of us, just to kind of put things in perspective. What are we doing here? What is the retreat? What does it mean, a retreat? What is the sitting? What are we doing when we're sitting? What is the what is the relationship with daily life of a practice like this? Like I said last night, the point is not to sit on the cushion 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, for however many, 70 years. The point is to live fully. And that involves standing up. This is just one aspect of life, sitting on the cushion. This is only one aspect of practice, as we say. So it's in quotes. Every single thing we do is practice, or can be, let's say. Every moment of life is a moment of awakening, or can be. Every phenomenon, the fly buzzing, can be, what we say, a gate to that awakening. Awakening simply being, instead of sitting here dreaming, projecting into the future, or clinging to some memories in the past, or trying to arrange how we want the person in front of us to look, act, speak, think, behave. Just experiencing it as it is. Experience the fullness of this moment. Experience the fullness of banging my face into the wall. Experience the fullness of being uncomfortable sitting in a certain position. Experience the fullness of being tired. Experience the fullness of cleaning the toilet, or not wanting to clean the toilet. Experience the fullness of the sound of this building cracking. It's cracking all the time. It's alive. It's moving. It's always moving, this building. It looks like it's really solid, but it's moving. Everything is moving. Even when you think you're sitting there still on your cushion and not moving, there's movement there. Constant movement. And when we do something like me sitting there focusing on waiting for the bell to ring, it's as if I'm grabbing onto something in the river. Instead of floating down the river, I'm grabbing onto a branch that's fallen into the river, this concept that the bell should ring. I grab onto it and I stay there. Instead of going along with the flow, allowing myself to flow freely. Sometimes I have to grab onto that branch to see where I am, to recognize it. It was necessary for me to focus on that for however long it was, 5 or 10 minutes, waiting for that bell to ring, so that I could become aware of it. And then when I became aware of it, okay, and I let go of the branch and I went on with the river. So, yeah, when I talk about materialism, you know, it's a notion that now has become is very present for us because our society is such a materialistic society. Or let's say the aspect of materialism is cultivated in our society. It's considered preferable. It's considered the it's what's considered most valuable, let's say. So, and that can be material in the sense of physical materialism, which involves, you know, having nice houses and cars and money. And clothing and looking a certain way and all of the that I think we all know what we're talking about when we talk about physical materials. And then we have psychological, between quotes, materialism, which involves cultivating certain emotions, passions, becoming someone important, becoming famous, having people like us, identifying with some image we have of ourselves, and then cultivating anything that will reinforce that. And then what we call spiritual materialism, which is, you know, there's an entire books written about it. Shogyam Trungpa, a Tibetan master, was the one who first coined that phrase and developed a lot of teachings around it. He didn't invent anything, it's just that he put a name on it. It's as old as humanity. All of this is as old as humanity. The spiritual materialism would be what I was saying about thinking that we will arrive somewhere in a spiritual way, that we will become, we will have bliss, we will feel good, we will become clear, we will. And it's identified with I, and I who will accomplish this, who will accomplish, who will attain, who will arrive. And it can be very subtle because it can take the form of I will do this, I will awaken so that I will have more influence on other people to help them awaken. Which is tricky because this, we call this the bodhisattva. Something sounds like that is what we call the bodhisattva way, which is to awaken for the benefit of others. When it takes on the materialist aspect, it's more involved with me than it is with the others. It's all about me. I will accomplish, I will arrive. And as long as we are doing these things and thinking that this is the key to happiness, we are only creating more difficulty for ourselves. So I just alert you to these different aspects. And as I am saying them, they're just words and concepts. And I'm aware of that, and I accept the limitations of that. And you can listen to them in that way, as words and concepts. And perhaps then say, well, what does that really mean? What do those things mean? What is that for me? What is my experience of those things? What is my experience of the fly flying around? What is my experience of the crow crowing? What is my experience of waiting for something to happen? What is my experience of bumping into the window? The example I always give is my experience of drinking this water is not yours. The only way to experience drinking the water is to drink it. That's what we're doing here. We're experiencing drinking the moment, let's say. And if I was expecting this to be wine, I would be disappointed, right? Or I might be happily surprised because I would be thinking, I don't want wine, but that's wine. And then I would taste it and I would be pleasantly surprised. But still, I will have spent that moment before expecting it to be something else. I also welcome your questions and comments. The first day is always strange for me, and I probably say this every time I start a retreat, because it's a new group. We are all coming from, like I said last night, our crazy whatever was going on in our lives. We were involved in traveling here and organizing and bringing things. And it takes a while to sort of settle. And the first, even in my interactions with you at the beginning, it's we're kind of getting to know one another. So, you know, I'm telling you all these things today just from my experience of these first few hours that we've spent together. As we go along, other things will happen. And other things will be said, and other kinds of exchanges will happen. So if you have anything you would like to bring up, it's welcome.
About that. About that. What did I do? Which did you do? I didn't hear. I couldn't hear it because I was late. But I guess it was you did.
Yes.
Because I told him that he had to start the clock, even if he were not on time. So, but I just said that. I didn't precise anything else. So I guess you...
So I stuck the bell.
Okay. Okay.
I thought that's what happened. In fact, I was sure.
I should wait for you.
Start the clock and wait.
Start the clock and wait.
Yeah, we wait till everyone is sitting before we ring the bell. But, you know, it's a very interesting experience. and I didn't mind, you know. I didn't care. And I thought that's probably what happened. And I thought probably, and I appreciate very much everyone's intentions to do the best they can. In fact, everyone is doing the best they can. And I was quite, felt quite happy about that. That, you know, there was this intention to keep to the schedule and start the bells and do whatever. And I know that's, I could have told you that's what happened. But the wonderful thing is, it gave us this perfect example of something we talk about, which is very a concrete example of something that we all do in so many different circumstances. So it's wonderful. Thank you for offering us that opportunity. And everything is an opportunity. You know, the thing that I love to cite is from the writer James Joyce, who told a writer friend who was asking him how his process of writing Ulysses was. Or maybe it was Finnegan's Wake, or both probably. And he said, well, I'm like a man walking down the street. I stumble on something, I trip, you know, I bump into the window or the bell doesn't ring, and I bend down and I pick it up, and it's exactly what I was looking for. That's how he wrote his books. That's how we can live our lives. Imagine if we lived our lives that way. It doesn't mean that I wanted to bump into that window. That what I picked up there was I wanted to bang my face. And I don't know if I will have bruises or what on the face, but it was the perfect thing. The bell not ringing, Nuno's intention was not at all that. But it was the perfect thing. It was the perfect, we stumbled there and boom, that's it. And the more that we sit, the more that kind of thing happens, where we stumble and we say, oh yeah, yeah. We see the value of things as they are. We see that everything is important. We see that every moment is precious. All of these kinds of things we say. Doesn't mean that we want to bang into doors and windows all the time. It doesn't mean that we want to forget our keys or something. But those are valuable moments. What does it mean that I forgot my keys? And not even so much what does it mean, what do I do then? What is that moment then? What do I, the bell didn't ring, I was waiting for it. Okay, I stumbled upon that. What do I do then? I notice it and I go on. And I include that, like Joyce took these things and included them in his books. His books were made from things that he found when he stumbled on the ground. Artists generally function that way. They maybe don't use that same terminology, but that's how the creative process, that's where creativity lies, let's say. It's not organized. It's not systematic. I would say it's not physics, but maybe physics is not organized or systematic either. But, you know, it's not mathematical formulas. Although mathematical formulas can be very creative. The formulas come also from stumbling upon. So, this is where creativity is. And this is where a meditation retreat is infinitely creative. We think of it not as being so. We think of it as boring. Right? You come in and sit here all day. If you tell your people and your friends and your life that you're going to sit, all day, 6 days. What? Why? It helps us to then appreciate what we're stumbling upon, right? It's very creative. Not long ago, I was in New York, and actually chose to go to Times Square, which I don't know if anyone has been to New York, but Times Square is intense. And at all hours of the night and day, it's intense. And we were going somewhere, I forget where we were going, but we had the possibility of going around Times Square. At first it was my husband who said, no, let's go to Times Square. And I said, yeah, that's a good idea, let's go to Times Square. So we went, there were a group of us, and we went right to Times Square. And wow, it's like the inner sanctum of entertainment or something, you know, of diverting attention, of distraction, let's say. It's the ultimate, it's the kingdom of distraction. With bright lights, noise, things flashing, all kinds of images and words going in all different directions and colors. And it's at, you know, this was like midnight and it was like the middle of the day. There was so much light. And so I thought, okay, so what do I do with that then? What is this? How do I include that? How do I include this? How do I include Times Square? What is Times Square about? Well, for me, it was very instructive as a sense of how we relate to what light means, how light can become distracting, how flashing images become. Take me away from what is, how it's a representation of how we would like things to be. It attracts so many people. And the very fact of its existence says something about its attraction and its appeal. Right? So, but the same thing, the 14th of July, in France, it's the national holiday, there are fireworks, right? These big, all over the country. And in Paris, all over the city, people gather in the squares, and on the bridges across the river, anywhere, so that they can see them. And as I was watching them, I was thinking, is this amazing? And watching people's faces, and it was almost more interesting to watch the people's faces than it was to watch the fireworks themselves. To see how fascinated we are by it and how attracted we are by it. And I could almost see this primitive relationship that humans had with fire. You know, it was fascinating. And what does that say? What was my attraction to it? Because I could easily be captivated by it as well. They were beautiful. What was beautiful about that? About colored lights in the night sky, arranged in patterns, and then disappearing. And then wanting them to happen again. And again, and sometimes my son would say to me, is it over? hoping that it wasn't. You know, he was expecting the end to come. And I said to him, no. Because I knew that it wouldn't be over until there had been something really spectacular. There would be like huge, all kinds of something really amazing, and then it would be over. And that my, just said what my son had said when he was much younger, when he was only about 2 or 3 maybe, probably 2, 2 and a half, we went to see a play that his sister was in, his older sister. And so we were all sitting in the audience and waiting, and we probably got there quite early so we could have good seats, and then the lights went out, and the audience had been talking and everything, and then the lights went out, and there was this moment of silence. And my son said, very loud, so that everyone could hear it, "Is it over?" He'd been waiting. He had been waiting, and then something happened, so it must be over. So, we do this all the time. We do it all the time. And when there's a change in the light, for example, you know, so of course he thinks when the lights go off, okay, then it's over, you know, or something happens, so it's over. Times Square, you know, there's this desire to have something eternal, something infinite, something something all-powerful, something all-knowing. And Times Square is kind of a representation of that desire. And New York is kind of a representation of that desire, this amazing power of the material world. Now, we have these representations everywhere. It doesn't, you don't have to go to Times Square to see it. You can just look at your own house. Look at your own body. Look at your own clothing. Look at look at your own desire to that the world will never change, or that you will stay forever, whatever age you are. Or that you will know everything. That you will constantly be able to understand how you're functioning, and you will have control over all of your reactions and your thoughts. Nothing will escape you, that's it. Or the opposite. We have often the opposite tendency of, okay, rejecting all things material, withdrawing from society, not knowing anything, rejecting New York, you know, when the when the planes crashed into the Twin Towers in New York, this was quite a statement. It could have been taken as a statement of, wow, this materialist thing has really gotten out of control. What are we doing? You know, because it was really symbolically an attack on the symbols of this materialism. However, it was a materialistic attack on materialism. So, and the reactions were, of course, then materialist. So, unfortunately, we missed that moment, I would say. So, I guess just, you don't have to go to Times Square, you can see the Times Square in yourself. you can see the you know, you don't have to go to a football match, or you don't have to go to the World Cup to, you have a football match and the World Cup in you, you know, you're like competing to win something and beat someone and score the goal, and it's all happening here. These outer manifestations, outer, I say in quotes, outer manifestations are just expressions of what we all are experiencing in ourselves anyway. So we can sit here all week and I won't say enjoy the show. But perhaps expand a bit our notion of what it is. Open to the limitlessness of it, to the possibilities, the creativity of sitting here in this moment. And not only sitting, but eating, walking, working, everything. Any other the comment about the bells? Appreciated comment. Any other? Anyone have any questions? Or it can be very practical about how to sit. It can be about the eating. Did it go okay this morning, the eating? No, it didn't. I tried to go a little slowly so that everyone could follow. The servers did a great job. It was quite impressive that this was the first time we had done this, and it went very smoothly. Really, I'm serious. Which makes me think, well, why didn't I do this before? Why didn't I bring this before?
All this three aspects of materialism, the physical, the psychological, the spiritual, we are always bumping into this until we realize this non-essence about it. Mm. So it's impossible not to... Mm.
Well, and the thing is that it's, the way that you present it too, it's there is a material aspect to life. The concrete relative world is that this is us. That's what we are. That's where we are. And we can't deny that. You know, to deny that, I would go in bumping into windows all the time. You know? There is the other aspect, however, though, that we don't pay any attention to, usually. Which I guess we can call the non-material aspect, maybe because we're talking about the material, so let's talk about the non-material. And the two, in fact, are not two, they function perfectly together, as one, in fact. But we experience it as two. And what happens is, right, it's impossible not to experience the material, but what happens is that we make that exclusive, that we focus exclusively on that, and we believe, we convince ourselves, that that is where happiness and well-being lie, is in the material aspect. And, you know, it's not necessarily that we think of it as being, if I have a beautiful house, if I have a beautiful car, if I have a wonderful job, if I have a lot of money. It may not necessarily be that. Of course, there are plenty of people who believe that, and there are the general values of our culture are that. That material, the material will bring us happiness. And then we may that doesn't bring us happiness, and so then we try something else. We try psychologically becoming powerful, clear, we may understand how everything works, we may understand all how where we came from, why we behave the way we do, all of the intrigues in our life and our history and all our neurosis and everything, and we may come to some, and we think that's where our happiness will lie, and we will ignore the other two aspects. Well, we'll have trouble then too, because we have to pay some attention to our material life. We have to eat. We have to have clothing. We have to function in this world. We have to be aware when there's things that we bump our face into, you know. And then, so then we may turn to the spiritual aspect and think that this is where we will find the ultimate happiness. But often what happens is we bring the same patterns here. We want to acquire knowledge. We want to acquire power. You know, we may step back from a career and being president of a corporation, but we come here and we want to be better than the other people who are with us here. And we want to occupy an important position in the spiritual world. Or we want to accumulate accomplishments. You know, so, okay, I have, you know, in this, sometimes in this practice I work with people with koans, and they want to accumulate, pass one after another and another and another and another. Or they want to, I don't really use much hierarchy, in fact I don't use, you know, I don't put any emphasis on hierarchy, but people probably establish in their heads that some person is more important than another, and so they want to accomplish what that person has accomplished. It may involve wanting to constantly arrive at some state that I feel great, I feel bliss, as I said. And then we focus only on that, and we're not paying any attention anymore to the material aspects, how it functions, how the group functions. We're not aware anymore of what our psychological motivations might be for all of this, and we lose track again. And in all of those aspects, we're missing the point that the whole cause of this dissatisfaction that we have, we're searching for happiness in these other aspects, the whole origin of that dissatisfaction is that we are clinging to the idea that it's somewhere else. And that comes from this belief that I am. And this I is not satisfied with. It can't be who it thinks it is, and so it tries to find ways to make it feel that way, or ways, it tries to eliminate ways that make it not feel that way. So Times Square, for example, then, would be an attempt, and quite successful in a sense, to divert our attention from darkness, from absence, from what we call, we could call it emptiness, we could call it non-material, we could call it the sky, you know, the flashing lights, the images, the words going across with all these messages, the advertising for all these products that, you know, sugar, beauty, wealth, all these things are all attempts to divert our attention away from this non-material. Because that's threatening. It's frightening, the non-material.
being aware it looks that it's not enough. It looks to me.
Mm-hmm. In what way is it not enough?
I was thinking about what your images and about your metaphors. Did you say that? Metaphors.
Yes.
And I was thinking that the importance of that, but the next step that's where the complications begin, I think. I want to say that when we react or when we act after being aware of something, that's the moment where the complications, let's say like that, can begin.
So you mean if you're aware of, can you give me an example? Do you have a concrete
example? There are examples of being aware of something.
Okay.
There are your own examples. You must do something with this awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's something you're going to do with that,
mm-hmm.
can be a great discovery or a great of great importance to you and the others, or can be more problems.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's true.
And I think the problem stays there, you know, the balance, the limit.
Yes, I understand what you're saying. And the maybe it's important to clarify when, for example, if we, the complications, as you say, would arise if I'm not sure in the examples I gave, okay, I'm aware that I'm waiting for the bell to ring. And so the complications would be that I would
not come at all here. Because you didn't hear the sound, for example.
Okay. Well, I was already sitting here and I was waiting for him to ring the bell. So because he didn't ring the bell, maybe I would leave or something. Say when I bumped into the into the door, the complication would be that I would how would you see a complication in that situation?
What I want to say is that what do you do with that awareness?
Mm-hmm.
Can do so many different ways.
Well, I would say you don't do anything. That the in one sense, I say we don't do anything in the sense of we don't have to add anything on. That the action that is required from the situation. If I am coming to the situation with awareness, will become evident that I offer a very simple example that might be more clear than these two would be: I'm walking down the street, an old woman or trips on the sidewalk and falls into the traffic. I immediately pull her back so that she won't be hurt. If I'm not aware, I don't even see her fall. Right? So, if I am aware, I see her, and instantly, before I start thinking, it's obvious that I don't even have to think about it, I will pull her back. I won't be be thinking, well, I don't have the right shoes to pull her back, or the other people will think I'm silly if I pull her back, or she's really irresponsible to fall into the trap, or the people who made this road were stupid, they weren't careful, she fell into the traffic, or those people in the cars are irresponsible, they're not paying attention, they're going to hit her. I'm not thinking any of these things. I just act according to the situation, because I'm aware of the situation. I'm aware that there's traffic coming, I'm aware that she tripped, and if I don't pick her up, she will be hurt. So I pick her up. This is an easy one. In that sense, I don't have to do anything with the awareness, because I'm aware of the situation and I act according to the situation. If I spilled this, we would know what to do. We would know how to react. In the situation where I'm waiting for the bell, and I become aware that I'm waiting for the bell, what I need to do is already included in the awareness. I'm aware of the entire situation. Before I became aware that I was waiting for it, I was just waiting for it, and waiting for it, and waiting for it. And at that, if I hadn't become aware of my waiting, I might have thought, why isn't he ringing it? He should. It should be this way. She should have told him. I should have told him. He should know. This is going to be a bad sitting. No one knows how long it's going on. Or I might have even become aware of the fact that I was late. So I didn't hear him ring the bell. And then I would have been annoyed with myself. And I would have blamed myself. I would have said, oh, I was late. That's terrible. I'm setting a terrible example, or whatever. Or I might have said, well, I was late, but he's supposed to wait for me. I'm the most important person here, so he should wait for me before he rings the bell. Or whatever, you know. But as soon as I become aware of this expectation I have, that other stuff is no longer there. There's nothing to do but sit. Just be present with it. Now, I understand your question, however, that, and it's true, that awareness is not enough. That's why in these practices, we stand up and move into the world. It's not enough. And it is completely enough. It's completely enough. It's both. The materialist aspect is it's not enough. And the non-material aspect is that it's enough. And they're both true, and they're both necessary, and they both work together.